This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, the Patriot Act is worse than we thought. The FBI has been lying to us about how they've been using it.
They've contracted with the three major phone companies in the United States to, behind our backs, get all sorts of information just by asking for it. No court involvement. Spying on us.
Scott Horton will be joining us with more information on the combatant status review tribunals that are going on in Guantanamo.
Scott Horton, one of the leaders of the Association of the City of New York Bar, is outraged at the 180-degree turn that this country has taken with respect to democratic rights.
We'll talk with Josh Dreitel, attorney for David Hicks, the first Guantanamo detainee set to go before a military tribunal tomorrow.
He's been held now for 5 years. Let's see what they do to him next.
And we'll talk about the Hutto Detention Facility, one of two in the country that houses children.
They're putting little kids from all over the world behind bars. I guess this is another version of Bush's No Child Left Behind.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. The Inspector General of the Justice Department has just found that the FBI has been abusing its administrative subpoena power in what's called national security letters. The FBI used this subpoena power to gather phone, bank, and credit information on thousands and thousands of citizens without court oversight. They also made, quote, unusual contracts, end quote, with three major phone companies to provide records without any legal process. The FBI then went and reported out numbers on how many people they spied on, which were totally false and underestimated. That is, they lied. This morning, we're going to be talking with Lisa Graves, Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Lisa, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa, we understand that the FBI has been caught lying again about the Patriot Act. What's going on this time?
Well, the Inspector General of the Justice Department just issued a report documenting that the FBI had not followed the law regarding powers that allow it to secretly request Americans' bank records, phone records, records of insurance companies, as well as Internet transactions. And so now we're seeing the effects on the Hill in terms of people calling for oversight and reform of these Patriot Act powers.
What's the FBI doing that it shouldn't be doing?
Well, the FBI, according to this investigative report, has been telling people, businesses that receive demands from it, that it is it needs their cooperation in an emergency when there has been no emergency. That's one of the violations that was found. In that instance, the Inspector General found that the FBI had at least on 700 occasions, or at least with respect to 700 requests, told businesses, perhaps phone companies and other telecommunications companies, for example, that it needed immediate compliance with a demand for information about subscribers here in the U.S. because of an emergency when there was no emergency.
And the phone companies played ball?
It certainly appears that way. And in fact, one of the most interesting revelations in the report is that midway through the last Congress, the previous Congress, apparently the FBI even entered into a contract with three telecommunications companies to speed information. And so aside from the national security letter power, it sounds like they paid for immediate access to records from some telephone companies.
Who are the phone companies? I think our listeners would like to know. We're speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies. Blow the whistle on these phone companies, Lisa.
Well, Michael, I wish I could. Unfortunately, the Inspector General did not reveal the names of those companies. This does fall into a broader problem that we've seen, which is with regard to the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping on Americans for over 5 years. We heard that telephone companies were cooperating and allowing the National Security Agency and the administration access to Americans' phone conversations without the court orders required by law. Now you have an instance where phone companies, unknown phone companies, but I suppose we could guess, are allowing access or providing more information potentially to records on people's phone calls, not necessarily their phone conversations, but the phone calls, under false claims of emergency, and even basically getting money to provide faster access to that information.
That's really a scandal. So these phone companies, it's not like they're not without lawyers and without resources. They truly are complicit in this kind of secret police activity.
Well, it certainly seems to be the case. They're, at least in those instances, being paid to provide increased access. But what I would say is what the Inspector General was focused on was the violation of the law by the FBI. And here you have an instance in which Congress dramatically changed the law about accessing Americans' financial records, accessing their internet transactions and phone transactions, accessing insurance records, things of that nature. They made it so easy for them to obtain these documents, and even with the reduced standard, the almost non-existent standard in the law, the FBI apparently didn't even follow those requirements.
So things are even worse than we suspected when the Patriot Act went through Congress with the support of both political parties. Civil libertarians and supporters of democratic rights around the country shuddered. And now you're telling us that we don't even have the protection of the Patriot Act.
Well, what's interesting is I was just looking at this issue, what the Department has said about these powers. And in last year's report from Attorney General Gonzalez, he said, and this is actually one of the clearest statements we've ever seen, he said that the Patriot Act means that the FBI, quote, is able to review and store information about American citizens and others in the United States who are not subjects of FBI foreign counterintelligence investigations and about whom the FBI has no individualized suspicion of illegal activity. And then he adds that's why they need to be mindful of any potential for abuse and why they need aggressive oversight. Well, that's a pretty clear statement of the far reach of these powers into Americans' private records. And yet we have seen Congress until for the last 4 or 5 years aiding and abetting in basically not having thorough oversight over these incredibly intrusive powers of people who don't even have to be suspected of doing anything wrong.
That information, as I understand it, is not only illegally garnered, but then it's stored, it's linked, shared, it's mined, and people's private and public lives all come together in this huge data bank for the FBI and the other governmental agencies to use as they would like.
Well, Michael, that's a very important point. The IG report indicates that once information is obtained through these national security letters, which, again, aren't based on a person doing anything wrong, that information is stored in what they call a data warehouse, which I think says a lot right there. And then it's accessible to tens of thousands of law enforcement agents, intelligence agents across the government, FBI and beyond the FBI.
What standard do they need to access this database warehouse?
I suspect that the standard is that they are authorized to be involved in intelligence anti-terrorism efforts. But the fact that, according to the IG, over 10,000 government employees at least have access to that information is pretty significant.
Let's take a step back. What's wrong with the notion that the government can do this? If you look at the government as I like to look at the government, which I don't think is our government, but an ideal government, the kind of government that we had hoped to form back after the Declaration of Independence, was a government that was representative of the people, that people had a right to anonymity, they had a right to democratic discussions, they had a right to decide who to vote for and then elect people, and those representatives would act according to the wishes of the people. But it seems to me this has all been stood on its head, and you've got a government that collects all this information and then manipulates the people they're supposed to represent.
I think that those are very interesting observations, Michael. I think that we have a situation in which I'm not sure how our constitutional democracy is actually surviving the combination of a genuine threat, the genuine threat we faced on September 11th, combined with an administration that seems determined to expand executive power with the least amount of checks possible. And in this instance, you have a situation in which the law was changed. It used to be that, of course, you could get these types of records, financial records, bank records, credit reports, or phone records on people who were suspected terrorists. I don't think anyone has any disagreement about that. How this power was changed in the Patriot Act, at the administration's insistence, was to allow them to access anyone's records in the U.S. on the notion that it would be relevant to an intelligence investigation or an anti-terrorism investigation, even if there's no information the person has done anything wrong. And these requests are issued solely by the FBI without any judicial oversight at all. There's no one checking them to make sure that they're focusing only on the terrorists. And in fact, under the law, they don't have to focus on the terrorists, as Gonzalez said in the 2006 annual report that I just mentioned to you. So it's true that Congress, our elected representatives, allowed this to occur by going along with the administration's demands immediately following September 11th. At the time, the administration was basically saying blood would be on the hands of any member of Congress if they didn't pass the Patriot Act immediately. But then last year, actually a year and a half ago in 2005, Congress had the chance to take another look at these powers, and it appears that the administration misled Congress about the extent to which they were using some of these powers and the extent to which there were any safeguards being enforced.
What do you conclude from this? What went wrong?
Well, I would say that the general thing that went wrong is what civil libertarians across the country have been saying, is that unchecked power corrupts. Unchecked power is inherently abusive and inherently intrusive, and this is the type of power that is unchecked because there is no external check on whose records are obtained, and then once they're obtained, they're basically kept forever and disseminated, and then people's names are basically associated with having been involved in a terrorism investigation, even if they've supposedly been cleared of any wrongdoing, as the IG made clear in his report. So I think what went wrong is that people overreacted in terms of giving such expansive powers and then not following up with having real oversight and real meaningful checks to protect people's privacy.
So how does this trickle down to the actual impact on someone's life once they've been spied on unlawfully, it seems, by our government?
Dahlia, I think that that's one of the things that remains to be seen. We've seen in recent months that the administration has proposed new rules for U.S. travelers, basically assigning people a risk number, a secret risk number that lives with them for 40 years based on unknown factors. You have a situation in which we don't know what's going to happen to people whose names end up in this database. Will there be an impact on them in terms of their right to travel? Will it have an impact on them in terms of employment or other opportunities for them? It's unclear, but what's clear is that the administration and the executive branch is amassing enormous amounts of information on people in this country who may not have done anything wrong. And in fact, as Gonzalez said, they now have the power to do so, even if the person hasn't done anything wrong, as long as the administration says to itself that they think having that information is relevant to a terrorism investigation.
How about Alberto Gonzalez? Where does he end up in all this?
Well, I would say that it's yet another blemish on his already blemished career. He is someone who promised Congress in the course of his confirmation process to become Attorney General that he understood the difference between being the president's aide and being Attorney General, and that he would defend the Constitution. I think his record in numerous ways, from the direct involvement in the torture issue and the violation of the Geneva Conventions or reinterpretation of them, his direct involvement in the NSA spying issues, his lack of serious oversight of the Justice Department over the use of these powers, basically being a willing pawn, going to the Congress and the American people and telling them everything's okay, giving assurances that aren't backed up by actual inside the Justice Department regulations or enforcement of protecting civil liberties. I think that he's definitely at fault.
I think he should step down.
Well, I think the calls for that are definitely growing across the country. In some ways, I think that it's a symptom of a larger problem. We have an administration that has demonstrated a lack of respect for civil liberties, in fact, a hostility toward Americans' fundamental rights. And that hostility is reflected in the people that it has appointed to some of these very powerful positions.
And those three major phone companies that handed over private customer records, what happens to them? I mean, it seems like some of them got paid for this information, and maybe some of them didn't, but they certainly were not within their rights to hand over information that should have been protected.
Maybe a class action lawsuit against them, Dahlia?
We'd like to see something. I mean, tell us, Lisa, a little bit more about these three phone companies. What do you think ought to happen to them under the law?
Well, it's unclear, and they certainly have very well-paid lobbyists who in the industry who have been already lobbying for immunity for the big three telephone companies that reportedly been involved in the warrantless wiretapping of Americans' conversations.
So, another theme of this administration, immunity, encouraging people to break the law and then providing immunity, ordering soldiers to torture people in Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities around the world, then coming back here and getting Congress to pass laws that say these people are now immune from further prosecution. And now we're seeing that they're going to major corporations, which we pay. We pay them. They're not doing us any favors. We pay them to provide us with a service. And sometimes we pay them way too much money for way too little service. In return, they're allowing our government to illegally spy on us. And now what are they doing? They're lobbying Congress, the people that we elect, to pass laws saying that they will now be immune from prosecution. This is just lovely.
It is a really awful picture in that way, in which you have a situation in which some businesses are being compensated both by the consumers and by the government to get access to those consumers' records, and to do so in the wiretapping instance, the warrantless wiretapping instance, without the proper legal authority, and in fact in violation of the plain requirement of the law that there be a court order. And we do know that they have been lobbying Congress hard for immunity from any consequence for their involvement in the NSA warrantless wiretapping. And I think they've made some unfortunate headway with some members of Congress from both parties. And so if the American people reject that, which I certainly would hope they would, they need to let their voices be heard, that this is unacceptable.
Is there any good news in all of this?
Well, I would say that there is some good news. First of all, this audit from the Inspector General was one that was forced upon the administration by our allies in Congress during the process of Patriot Act reauthorization. During the Patriot Act reauthorization debate, in which thousands and thousands of voices were heard from across the country, we were able to get this thorough investigation made part of the law. We weren't able to fix this particular provision in the Patriot Act at the time in 2005. We had hoped to, but instead, since we could not, given the political dynamics at that time, we were able to get this report, hoping that when the truth came out, we would be able to then use the truth to get this power fixed. So now we have a glimpse of the truth, and so now we have the opportunity to try to really fix this power and also make sure the American people understand that they do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their financial records, in their phone records, in their internet transactions, and that these powers need to be properly focused on those who would do us harm, and not on innocent Americans and other people in the country who've done nothing wrong. So I think this really represents an opportunity to take this information and demand the reform of these powers that should have happened in 2005 but didn't.
Lisa Graves, Deputy Director of the Center for National Security Studies, I agree with you. I think I'd go you one step further. I'd say not only reform, I think we should abolish the Patriot Act, but that's a subject for another time. We wanted to thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Lisa Graves, it's always good to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure. It was wonderful talking with you both.
I think this recent disaster with the Patriot Act, where the FBI just went ahead and ignored it in complicity with the three major phone companies, shows what we said all along when the reauthorization of the Patriot Act was being discussed. And we all said on Law and Disorder, they should just abolish the thing. Others said, no, we can tinker with it. We can fix it. We can make these reporting requirements so that we still defend ourselves against terrorism. My own thought was that this whole notion of terrorism is totally overhyped, that there hasn't been any terrorism since 9/11. Terrorism really, on a world scale, is not one of our great concerns. If you think about it, people who die of unnecessary disease, people who die of hunger.
Heart disease,
that's tobacco. That's what takes a horrible toll across the planet. Only several hundred people a year. Not that it's good, and I think we should do what we can to stop it. But it's totally overhyped, and they use the hype to allow for these police state methods like the Patriot Act.
Yeah.
David Hicks was the Center for Constitutional Rights' first client and in the first group of detainees taken to Guantanamo. He's an Australian and is now the first person charged before the reconstituted Military Commissions Act. He was charged earlier, but those commissions were held illegal by the Supreme Court in the Hamden case. He has been charged with one count of material aid to terrorism, which is not usually viewed as a war crime. To the extent any crimes are triable by the military commissions, they must be war crimes. Australia, under right-wing Premier John Howard, unlike the United Kingdom, has willingly gone along with this trial and has not insisted on Hicks's return. Josh Traitel joins us today. He's David Hicks's civilian attorney. Welcome, Josh, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
We understand that you're the civilian lawyer for David Hicks, the Australian who's in Gitmo. Can you tell our listeners what he's doing there and what you're trying to do for him?
Well, he's been detained there since the beginning of 2002, and he's now facing a military commission. He's the first person charged in the new military commission system. He was charged under the old system, which we challenged and which was invalidated by the Supreme Court, and now we're starting the whole process again with a new system.
What disturbs us, and we've been covering this over the many months, is that these military commissions don't have to abide by the usual fair play of a trial, that they can use hearsay evidence, they can use evidence obtained by torture. They don't necessarily have a right to have their attorney present when they're doing everything. Can you tell us what you expect is going to happen at this hearing?
We'll first have motions that we'll be making to challenge the commissions and challenge the one charge that remains against David. We will have motions challenging evidence, to suppress evidence, to get into the whole issue of how evidence has been obtained in this case, because, like many of the other cases, there's no independent evidence other than what has been obtained through the interrogation and abuse process and coercion that has gone on for these detainees since they've been apprehended wherever, whether it's been in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Africa or Europe or wherever they've been taken into custody and then sent to Guantanamo.
Josh, most of our listeners don't have a legal background. Can you explain in very real terms what the government is doing and offering instead of access to real courts, the criminal courts that we have here in the United States, what the U.S. government has instead for the Guantanamo detainees?
Well, it's a system that's essentially designed to convict and not to a fair adjudication of the facts. Hearsay, in other words, you don't have to actually have the witness in court, and a interrogator can come in and read what he or she claims is the conversation that they had with the detainee, and they won't have to call the detainee. Other statements, again, hearsay without the actual person, so you can't cross-examine. Evidence that's the product of torture or of abuse may come in. It's a system that's run by the Department of Defense without any independent monitoring, without any independent ability to review. The President and the Secretary of Defense have already said that these people are all guilty.
These are the military commissions.
Yes.
And who sits on a military commission? What does it look like? Where is it held?
Well, it'll be held in Guantanamo, and it'll be presiding officer and members of a, then jury members, essentially.
And the jury members are not civilians, are they?
No. They'll be military people picked.
How would anybody defend this as being something other than a kangaroo court?
Well, that's that's what it is. And so
you and other lawyers who have come forward, in my opinion, in the finest tradition of the bar here in America, these lawyers have been under tremendous criticism, particularly by the government, for aiding and abetting terrorism. How do you defend yourself against that charge?
Well, first, thank you for your opinion on it. But, well, it's the charges are, I guess, a demonstration that we are being effective. That the lawyers who are fighting this system are effective, because rather than contest on the merits, and every time we've gone to the Supreme Court, we've won these cases. So rather than contest us on the merits, the administration has tried to divert attention and distract attention and create a different issue. John Adams, who was president of the United States, represented the British soldiers charged in the Boston Massacre before the Revolution. So it's in the finest tradition of the United States and the Constitution to defend those who need counsel and defend those who are accused, despite the nature of the offense charged, because you never know who's guilty and who's not. I mean, these are charges that are being laid against David Hicks that weren't even crimes that he could be charged with when they occurred. It's called ex post facto, but what they're really trying to do is sort of, after the fact, create an offense to charge him with that they can hold him responsible for. And obviously we think that's wrong as well. But the whole issue about the lawyers, it's really just it's a red herring. It's designed to intimidate and distract, and I don't think it's been successful. I think the outcomes have been rather good in terms of the reaction from the legal community.
I know that he's now being charged with providing material support for terrorism, but before, I remember some more serious charges were levied against him. What happened?
Well, two things. One is that the Supreme Court held that some of these charges, they didn't hold it with respect directly to David, but they did hold it in the context of their opinion. The justices held that a couple of the charges were not law of war crimes, or at least had certain elements that couldn't be met here. So, for example, aiding the enemy, you have to actually have to have allegiance to someone. So David had no allegiance to the United States. He could not be found guilty of aiding the enemy or charged with it. The other crime was, one of the other crimes initially was an attempted murder by an unlawful combatant. And I think the government, that charge was stricken a couple of weeks ago, when I think that they realized, well, they knew all along, but they tried to get away with it the first time. But this time they felt differently, because David never fired a gun. He never was in a battle. He never attempted to murder anyone. And so attenuated from that kind of charge could not stand. Material support for terrorism is a very broad statute, so they're hoping to kind of mix in all of that breath as a substitute for more specific charges that they know can't be laid against David. And these shouldn't be either, but we're going to have to face them.
I want to ask you about the case of Ahmed Omar Abu Ali that we've been following here on Law and Disorder. Listeners will remember he is the American citizen who was a foreign exchange student in Saudi Arabia, was picked up by Saudi authorities, allegedly tortured into confessing a couple of different things, but I believe among them was he might have said that he was going to free all Guantanamo detainees or assassinate President Bush. I don't remember what was among there. But there was very good evidence that he was tortured into saying this. And, of course, Saudi Arabia has an astronomical rate of confessions from getting confessions from prisoners, something like 99%.
Right.
And in a trial that did not allow even the U.S. State Department reports entered into evidence that say that most Saudi prisoners are indeed tortured in interrogation. It ended badly, and I believe he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. And you're handling the appeal. What's going on with that?
Well, we have almost finished the briefing. There's one brief left to be filed by the government, and we're scheduled to argue the appeal in the Fourth Circuit in Richmond in May. So sometime towards the end of May, probably that second to last week of May, from what I understand, but we don't have a specific date yet. But we have filed our brief attacking the conviction on a variety of grounds. We're hopeful, and we'll see how it turns out.
Well, Josh, we at Law and Disorder are going to follow your steps down there. We hope to get you back on the show. We wish you every success. You're a real credit to the bar, Josh Dreitel. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The Don Hutto Immigration Detention Facility in Tyler, Texas, is one of two detention facilities in the United States that houses families, including children. The ACLU of Texas is suing the Department of Homeland Security and the Hutto Immigration Detention Facility, saying that adults and children at the center, which used to be a prison, live in jail-like conditions, and that the children aren't given adequate schooling or medical care. Overall, they say conditions are terrible. Today, we're going to talk with lead counsel on the lawsuit, Lisa Graybill. Lisa is the legal director for the ACLU of Texas. Welcome, Lisa, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Lisa, tell us about Hutto and your lawsuit.
Well, we, the ACLU of Texas, along with the National Racial Justice Project of the ACLU in New York, and a professor at the University of Texas School of Law Immigration Clinic, filed our Hutto lawsuit in federal court in the Western District of Texas last Tuesday, March 6.
What is the Hutto Immigration Detention Facility?
Hutto is one of two facilities of its kind in the country where immigrant families are detained, meaning families with children, minor children. The other facility is in Berks County, Pennsylvania, and it's in a converted nursing home. In contrast, the Hutto facility here just north of Austin is in a former county jail, which looks like a jail, acts like a jail, feels like a jail when you're inside. The Hutto facility has a capacity of about 512 people. The more recent census indicate around 400 people are there, of which about 200 are children. In contrast, Berks only houses 80 people, and again, it's in a converted nursing home, so a fairly different environment than a medium security prison.
And how do people end up in that facility?
Variety of ways. Some people who are there are what's termed arriving aliens, people who come across the border and or are apprehended, either, you know, when they present themselves to immigration officials or when they make an unauthorized entry. Some folks are people who overstayed work visas or other kinds of visas and were picked up, placed in the facility.
How do they justify imprisoning children?
Well, the government contends that the, quote, catch and release program isn't working, and that folks who, like families previously, who were allowed into the United States, came into the United States seeking asylum, like many of our clients in the Hutto litigation are, were previously allowed to set up their residence, and as long as they continued to comply with court requests and directives, attend hearings, notify the court and ICE when they relocated, they were allowed to sort of carry on during the pendency of their, in many of our cases, asylum claims. The government decided that folks weren't showing up. We don't have any evidence of that. Certainly none of our clients were delinquent or otherwise tried to avoid their immigration hearings or disappear off the map. But the government's decided that this is a critical way that they're going to prevent continued illegal immigration. I would point out that 8 of our 10 plaintiffs are, in fact, the children of asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution in their home countries.
And they flee persecution there and they wind up getting it here.
Yes, a point that several of them have made, sometimes in tears, saying to us that they thought that they were fleeing, you know, in some cases, these inexplicable jail terms and sentences where they felt like they ended up behind bars and the rest of the world had forgotten about them. And some of them say that being in Hutto feels as hopeless as that felt, even though the conditions may be very different.
What kind of conditions are they living in?
Well, we're particularly concerned. Our plaintiffs are all children, and the government is bound by the terms of a settlement agreement in Flores versus Meese, which is a case that comes out of the Central District of California, in which the INS, ICE's predecessor agency, was required to do three main things. One is release children in its custody when at all possible to the least, sort of use the least restrictive or alternative in placing, in that case, unaccompanied minors with family members or other relatives. Second, for those that are detained, they need to be detained in the least restrictive possible environment, meaning that things like shelters or family centers, halfway houses, are more appropriate. And finally, the Flores settlement agreement which governs all minors in INS custody and still governs that population to this day, requires the government, for those minors it does detain that are determined to be danger to or a security flight risk, for those minors that are detained, the government's required to provide adequate educational services, medical services, nutrition, etc. And it's our contention that there's no reason for these immigrant children and their families to be detained. Like I said, none of them have been shown to be any kind of flight risk or any kind of safety risk. There's no reason that they couldn't be paroled out with their families.
Tell us about the conditions. You've explained to us the law that governs what Hutto should be like. What is it like inside Hutto?
Well, for starters, it's certainly not the least restrictive alternative because it is a jail. There are gates. There, until very recently, was barbed wire surrounding the entire facility. It looks like a big county jail, and that's exactly what it was. Access is controlled through master control. There's no free movement about the facility, so it feels very much like a jail. Until the 1st of January, kids were receiving only 1 hour of education a day, which is not in compliance with FLORIS, nor is it in compliance with the Texas Education Code. After January 1st, kids started getting as many as 4 hours of education a day. They're divided up by elementary, middle, and high school level, so they're divided by age. Many of the kids don't speak English, or certainly don't speak it as a first language. Many of the teachers don't speak Spanish or any of the other languages that are common to the population. So kids have told us they do a lot of coloring and watching videos and movies. All of our clients have lost weight, some of them significant amounts, since they've been detained. The food is reportedly literally inedible. Kids, especially families with small kids, have complained to us that they're given only 10 to 20 minutes to eat, and parents have said it's just impossible to get children to eat food that's unappetizing in the first instance and to get them to do it quickly enough. But after that, food is taken and thrown away.
Lisa, I want to remind our listeners who have made just tuned in, we're talking with Lisa Graybill, who's the legal director of the ACLU in Texas. She's just started this very important lawsuit against really child abuse. Lisa, if you had your druthers, what kind of relief do you want to get from the judge in this case?
Well, we'd like to see not just our clients, honestly, but all the children and the families who are detained at the Hutto facility who aren't adjudicated to be flight risks or safety risks of any kind, released and placed in least restrictive alternatives, which is in fact what Congress has directed in appropriations for ICE, as well as what the FLORIS settlement requires. And that can mean a variety of options. The ICE has experimented with some different options, including electronic monitoring, that the Vera Institute of Justice has done some pretty comprehensive research on the efficacy and success of that. And that would be a much less restrictive, much less harmful, and honestly, much less expensive way to handle immigrant families during the pendency of their claims than locking them up.
What's the cost of this?
Via an open records request, we discovered that the federal government is contracting with Williamson County, the county where Hutto is located, which is then contracting also with the Corrections Corporation of America.
That figures.
To pay for the housing of the detainees, and it's running the taxpayers about $3 million a month.
Wow. $3 million a month?
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible figure.
Correction Corporation of America, for our listeners who don't know, is a private prison concern. They've privatized prisons. You can own stock in this, and you can actually make money through the efforts of this company in imprisoning human beings.
Lisa, can you tell us about some of your clients?
Oh, they're amazing kids, and to see them in this situation is painful as a lawyer and someone who cares for them. Our kids range in age from 4 years to 15. They come from countries all across the globe, Somalia, Haiti, Guyana, Iran, and they are great kids who don't understand why they're in jail with their parents.
Well, we wish you the best of luck, and we'd love to have you on to discuss your upcoming victory.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I would look forward to that.
Lisa Graybill, legal director of the ACLU of Texas, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hundreds of lawyers, many from some of the finest corporate law firms in the country, have stepped forward pro bono to defend detainees at Guantanamo. The government attorney in the Department of Justice in charge of Guantanamo went so far as to criticize these pro bono lawyers and suggested that their law firms lose corporate business because of their civil liberties efforts. His criticism was roundly smashed by legal organizations, including the American Bar Association. The attacks on these lawyers, who in our opinion are upholding the finest traditions of the bar, are continuing, even today in the Wall Street Journal. Today we talk with Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the Bar Association of the City of New York, and also a professor of law at Columbia University. Scott Horton, welcome again to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
I've been seeing criticism, including in Wall Street Journal recently, of people like you who are critical of the Guantanamo Bay situation and critical of a number of attorneys who, like our own Michael Ratner, have been representing people down there. It seems to us that the attorneys that have stepped forward, most of them doing it pro bono, are really representative of the finest characteristics of the American bar, going all the way back to the days when John Adams represented people right before the American Revolution, when he was representing British soldiers. Nonetheless, we've been seeing these really vitriolic editorials and personal criticisms, even of Michael Ratner. What was your take on that?
Well, I think it showed something that was seriously amiss in the Department of Defense. In fact, the term they keep banting about is called lawfare. This is an ideological doctrine that was developed by some neocon extremists. It goes back and its origins roughly to the early 1990s, and in particular being used by two neocons, David Rifkin and Lee Casey. And they use it to describe people who insist on applying the rule of law in warfare times. Now, we've always had the rule of law. It's always been an adjunct of war. In fact, we've had a court-martial system. People can break the law during wartime, too. They get tried when they break the law, and we have a military court system that tries them. The suggestion here that's borne out by Mr. Casey and Rifkin and seems to be embraced by a lot of people in the Pentagon is that there's no need for any justice, that the president or his agents should simply decide what happens to people, condemn them, put them in prison for indefinite periods of detention, or punish them without any sort of legal process. And, of course, we have a name for that. It's tyranny.
What did you think of the person at the Department of Justice, the person who was in charge of Gitmo prisoners, coming out and saying that the law firms that have allowed their associates and partners to go down to Gitmo and who have done all this pro bono work, I think there's several hundred lawyers, and this Department of Justice official suggested that the corporate firms who use these law firms cease using them and not pay them any fees and punish them for allowing their associates to go down to Gitmo and represent Guantanamo Bay prisoners. What did you think of that kind of position?
Well, yeah, that, of course, was Cully Stimson. And not only did he make that statement, that is, he went on the Federal Radio Network and actually read out a list of 12 law firms, all with multi-part names, and made a direct appeal to their clients to fire them, to go away, take their business away, because they were handling these cases as a pro bono matter. He did that, and at the same time, we saw an editorial published in the Wall Street Journal that made exactly the same appeal. Very, very clear that these two things were carefully orchestrated and done together, and also very clear that this was reflecting policy of the Pentagon. And it's completely reprehensible and completely contrary to American traditions. I mean, I'll just give you an example. We had military commissions before in our history. We had a very high-profile military commission that occurred during the Second World War with German saboteurs who came on land left by a German submarine. They were captured when one of them went to the FBI and turned himself in, and they were put on trial. In fact, President Roosevelt ordered the commission proceeding. A very prominent North Carolina lawyer named Royal handled the defense for these would-be saboteurs, handled it very, very aggressively, and he did it by attacking the legality of the commissions, all the things that are going on right now. Well, that lawyer, Mr. Royal, in the end, for his very, very good and tenacious work, was complimented by the Attorney General and by the Secretary of War. This is before we had a Defense Department. He was promoted, becoming a brigadier general. He became the undersecretary of war, and he served as the last secretary of war. And when he was appointed, his brave and dedicated work as defense counsel was one of the things that was cited as one of the bases for his appointment as the secretary of war. That's the American tradition. And what we see right now is right-wing hysteria.
How do you account for this 180-degree turn?
I'd say it's pretty simple. It's being articulated by people who have no faith in all the things that America stands for, starting with justice, starting with an adversarial legal system. They have no faith or confidence in the fundamental rights of our legal system, including the right of confrontation and the right of zealous advocacy and a sound defense for people who are accused.
We're talking with Scott Horton, chair of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association and adjunct professor of law at Columbia University. Scott, tell us a little bit about something that's happening right now at Guantanamo, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, I believe they're called, and from what I understand, those 14 detainees who were at hidden CIA black sites around the world and transferred to Guantanamo Bay last year are due to come up before these review tribunals. What are they, and who are these people who are being brought up before them?
Well, the answer to the second question, let me answer that first. Who are these people who are being brought up? The answer is we don't know. We don't know because the Department of Defense refuses to disclose the names or even detailed information about the identities of the people who are being brought up before the boards. Now, what is the function of these CSRTs? They're not trial courts, and the people are not being accused of any crimes or wrongdoings. The purpose of these boards is to determine the status of people who are being held. So it's to determine whether they are unlawful combatants, lawful combatants, or people who are wrongly detained to begin with. And these proceedings are, I would say, kangaroo courts, but that would be far too generous because they're far less than any kangaroo court I've ever seen before. The people who are there are not given, they're not allowed to confront the evidence that's presented against them. So there's secret evidence that's presented. And
so they don't even see the evidence?
I'll put it this way. They may see some evidence, but they don't see all the evidence because there's secret or classified information that's withheld from them. And they are not allowed to learn what the source of it is. They're not allowed to have defense counsel defend them or present their case, which is what makes these things less than a kangaroo court. But, you know, most outrageously of all, we are not permitted to go attend and observe these cases. They are conducted in complete secrecy. I'll just point out that in the English-speaking world, the rule was set in 1646. That's 360 years ago, legal proceedings would always be public, that the doors to the court would be open, and that's as an insurance of justice. So what we see here is going back to rules in place from before the time of King Charles I.
Well, maybe this isn't real legal proceeding. It's just a setup.
It is nothing so dignified as a court, that's for sure.
So just to give us a sense, people who've been jailed at the CIA black sites and quite possibly tortured, having been brought through I don't know what, come to Guantanamo Bay. We don't know what their conditions are there, but we can assume it's quite bad. They're brought in front of a closed court, no journalists, no attorney, no one to explain to them what the process is. They're put up against evidence that they can't see. And who determines their fate?
And then there is a tribunal of military officers which will make a determination. And those officers are, of course, under command authority, and the command authority has prejudged the people here, saying that they're the worst of the worst. That, in fact, is a statement of the Secretary of Defense, who is the line superior of all the people who are making this determination. So it makes it very, very difficult for them to do anything other than find that these people should continue to be detained. One more thing that really needs to be stressed here is the Department of Defense decided to make all these proceedings secret so that no one could go there and monitor them. We know very clearly why they've done that. They take the position that these detainees might make statements about what was done to them during their detention, that is, that they were tortured and abused. And in the viewpoint of the Bush administration, both the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense, the fact that they were tortured and how they were tortured is a state secret, which we are not entitled to know about. And that's the reason why the proceedings are closed and why they will issue transcripts later, which they've carefully redacted. And if anyone says what was done to them, that'll all be struck out as secret material.
So the fact that their torture might be exposed is the entire reason that these proceedings are secret.
That's correct. The administration says that it would disclose super sensitive secret information, namely interrogation techniques, but that's manure. I mean, we know why they're suppressing this information, and it's because they have been tortured, and the fact that they're being tortured is criminal conduct, and they're trying to avoid further information or further substantiation of their own criminal conduct.
Well, Scott, in a wishful thinking way, if suddenly Dahlia and I were to appoint Scott Horton as new chair to resolve all this, what would you do to make it right?
We do need to have status tribunals as they've been provided, but these tribunals, because these people have been detained for so many years, these tribunals should occur according to regular trial norms. In fact, what I would do and what the American Bar, by and large, has approved is using the American military court-martial process. And by the way, court-martials in our system produce convictions in the great majority of cases, more than 90% of all cases. It's hardly something limp-wristed, as Ann Coulter might say. A very, very stern form of justice. I think we all feel that, you know, or most of us feel, that system, those forms of military courts, will be perfectly sufficient. They provide a right of confrontation, a right to hear evidence, a right to present evidence, and formal, correct trial procedure. I think the only thing that's missing here is justice. And by the way, I'm not going to say that these people are innocent or that they're guilty. I'm going to say simply, I don't know. I think we should just have a proper process through which the accusations against them are presented, they're given an opportunity to defend them, and then a fair, open-minded judge will make a determination.
That's what we're asking for in the very absence of those simple and very standard basic measures of justice that we have employed in the United States for so long indicates that, to me, that the United States really doesn't have the hard evidence against these people that they think they do, or they try to tell us that they do.
I don't know what the U.S. has or doesn't have because we haven't seen any proceedings, but I know looking at Guantanamo, you know, roughly two-thirds of the people held have been released, and I have to say that that's, you know, obviously I hope that the United States is not releasing people that they think are hardened terrorists who are going to attack us. That would be a very foolish thing. I have to think that they've made a conclusion that they don't present a threat. This is not just about doing justice. It's also about the appearance of doing justice. That is, it's very important for people out there in the world today to think that the U.S. has a sense of justice and follows it with respect to these detainees, that they're treated fairly. And around the world today, Guantanamo is viewed as really a badge of shame for the United States. Angela Merkel, the Prime Minister of Germany, has said that. England's Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, our closest ally, has openly said that. Most of our friends in the world have said that. And it's, you know, very, very important that we overcome this and that we demonstrate our propensity for doing justice, which, by the way, is what Americans did at the end of World War II. I think I'm very proud of, you know, what happened at Nuremberg. We held ourselves to very, very high standards, and we came off looking very good.
Well, I have some suggestions for some new people we could put into a Nuremberg doc. But with that, I wanted to thank you, Scott Horton. You're the chair of the International Law Committee at the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, professor at Columbia Law School. It's just wonderful to have you on the show. We thank you and urge you to keep up your good work.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.